Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Story time.
I've been lurking around your podcast long enough that I thought this story might be of interest to some people. I promise this is all genuine. I've done my best to limit embellishments and tell everything factually. This did happen 10 years ago, so I'm a little fuzzy on some of the details, but I've noted that where necessary. So when I was 15, way back in 2006, my best friend Michelle, her parents, James and Laura, and some family friends, Janet and Trevor, invited my friend Emma and I to spend a week with them at this place called Grindel's Hut. Grindel's Hut is a cottage in the middle of the Vulkathunya-Gammon Ranges National Park, about 7 hours' drive from Adelaide, the capital city of South Australia. It's actually a cottage next to a tiny hut built by stockman John Grindel back in the early 1900s, more on him later. Her family had stayed there a few times and said it was absolutely stunning. One place they were really keen to revisit was Bunyip Chasm. The photos I've seen look amazing. Unusually colored rocks, ferns and waterfalls all around this narrow chasm deep in the bushland. Again, more on that later. That far north, it's all dirt roads. We were driving a 4WD station wagon, rugged car but didn't have much clearance. While Janet and Trevor drove a Land Rover, which was far more ideal for the terrain. It was the middle of winter, so heavy rains had turned large sections of road into muddy slip and slides, and a few creeks along the way had flooded, covering the roads. We managed to get as far as Iga Warda, this brilliant Aboriginal cultural center. Campsite run by the Adnyamatana people. The park ranger came through and said the road ahead was almost unpassable and they had to close it for safety, so we decided to rent a couple of cabins at Iga Warda and wait for the roads to dry up. I'm so glad we did because it was honestly one of the best experiences of my life. During the day we went on bush walks to cave painting sites and at night there'd be a big bonfire where we'd sing songs and hear traditional stories. Some of it was a bit trying though. On the first night a bus full of Aboriginal foster kids rocked up. We were told by their teachers, carers, that they were all problem children who had been in the foster system for a while, constantly being handed on by families who couldn't handle them. We did feel really sorry for them. They'd clearly had hard lives, but in all honesty, for the most part, they were horrid little shits. These kids were all 7 to 12 years old, constantly screaming, fighting and using swear words I'd never consider using even now, and they were not afraid of anyone. They completely vandalized the public areas of the campsite, trashed the games room and broke the latticing off of a rotunda. The camp staff were surprisingly cool about it. I expected them to go ballistic. They sat all the kids down and told them off obviously, but the kids just laughed. However, despite being little hooligans, they did still have an appreciation for country and Aboriginal culture. One of the stories were learned around the campfire that first night was about an evil spirit man. It had a name, but I have no idea how to spell it. We all learned about him in a fun little song written by one of the elders. The lyrics were about walking home at night and having the spirit man following you, so you start running away or he'll curse you. Typing that out, it's actually super creepy, but somehow the song was still fun and a bit silly. That first night none of us got much sleep because the kids were all up screaming and carrying on, but the next day they got taken out on a private bush walk with some of the elders and they came far more solemn. I was taken aback. They told us that they'd learnt secret things they couldn't tell us white fellas, and all of a sudden they didn't think the evil spirit man was so funny anymore. That night they were all quite well behaved. A few tried staying up late and being silly, but the rest would shush them up saying the spirit man would come. They seemed genuinely afraid. The change in their behavior was so noticeable I started to get a little worried myself. One of the Adnyamatana people's most important stories is about the rainbow serpent Aku Ra, who is responsible for creating the land and animals. The story talks about how Aku Ra came down from the ranges to drink all the water in Lake Froom before returning to rest in Bunyip Chasm. This was really interesting to us because Bunyip Chasm was on the top of our list of places to visit. Now, as most people would know, the Aboriginal people are deeply connected to their country and there are often many sacred places that need to be respected or treated with care. For the Adnyamatana people, Bunyip Chasm is one of them. I'm ashamed to say I don't know the traditional name for the site. We ended up spending 3 days at Iga Warda. When we left we mentioned that we wanted to visit Bunyip Chasm and the staff got a little funny about it. Again, it's a sacred site and they take that seriously, as we should have too. They advised us not to go there, but if we did, to be careful. Honestly, the more I think about it, the more frustrated I am that we didn't listen. We're all very open-minded people. Michelle's parents border on being hippies, so we greatly respect Aboriginal culture, but obviously not enough to stop us going to one of their scared places. Anyway, on we traveled to our original destination, Grindel's Hut. Now Grindel's Hut is the most remote place I have ever been to in my life. There is nothing out there but endless bushland. I honestly can't describe it in a way that isn't wanky, but there is just something about such ancient untouched Australian bushland that is deeply moving. It feels so empty but also so incredibly full of life and energy, it can honestly be a little overwhelming if you open yourself up to it. I nearly had a panic attack when I spent too long thinking about how far away from anything we were. The only building nearby is the ranger's station. We stopped in there to collect the key and register ourselves. You have to let them know where you're going, what you're doing, and when you'll return in case something happens and they have to come find you. Again, we mentioned we planned to go to Bunyip Chasm. Apparently, when Michelle's family had last been through, it was fairly well advertised as a popular hiking trail or place of interest, but we saw almost nothing about it on our way up. The ranger said they decided to stop advertising it because there had been quite a few accidents. Obviously curious, we asked her more about it. Just a few more background details here to help paint the picture. The chasm is a few kilometers up from Grindel's hut. To get there, you drive your car to the end of a dirt track to a place called Loch Ness Well. Spoopy. Then you have to walk about 3 hours up a gorge through the creek bed until you finally reach a dead end with only a narrow path through. This is the beginning of the chasm. I5Q used to be able to just walk in, but now there was a big boulder blocking the entrance. Apparently this doesn't deter people and most of them managed to climb over the boulder and get in. So obviously when scrambling over rocks is involved, there going to be some injuries. First there were a few sprains, a cracked wrist here and there, then a broken leg that required the rangers to go in and carry the person out. I vaguely recall hearing about a death at some point, but I'm reluctant to say that's a fact. Because of all these injuries, they decided to try and make it safer by putting proper ladders in. Two tradies went in and while they were drilling holes to install the ladder, one of them slipped and cracked his skull. That was when it was decided it wasn't worth the risk and they stopped advertising it. The ladder was never installed. Michelle's parents are highly optimistic people, so they only found all this curious while my friends and I were quietly apprehensive. Echoing the staff at Eagle Warda, the ranger recommended that we not go there at all, but if we did, to be careful. The main access to Grindel's hut is via A4WD track around the gorge that surrounds it, but it hadn't been graded recently, and since the wagon didn't have enough clearance to make it through, we left it at the ranger's station, loaded all our supplies into the Land Rover, and Janet and Trevor drove in while we made the 11-kilometer, approx, trek through the gorge. Just even more evidence as to how extremely isolated this place is. We finally make it to the cottage when the rains come in again. After all the hiking, we were glad to just stay indoors and read for a day or two. So this was when we learnt the unsettling backstory of the location. So as I said, the cottage you stay in is built in front of the original hut, which is horribly dilapidated and super creepy now, built by cattle farmer John Grindel in 1918. Several mysterious incidences had occurred there. I can't remember the full story, but roughly John's cattle began disappearing. His mule was killed, then one of the men he hired to help him muster the cattle 1 year went missing and was found to be murdered. Grindel was convicted and jailed but spared hanging. Apparently Grindel's ghost has been seen around the old hut, which having seen the hut I do not doubt in the slightest. But aside from getting the creeps from the old hut, I never experienced anything personally. By the time the rain cleared up and we finally set out for the chasm, I was more creeped out by the hut than all the warnings we'd been given. The walk up the creek bed was beautiful. The rains meant it was flowing in most places, so we had to rock hop for a fair bit of it, which was fun. There were frogs, birds and kangaroos about, absolutely ideal hike. About halfway along we came across another group. They were staying at the campsite back near the ranger station and had driven in specifically to visit the chasm. Despite it not being heavily advertised, the chasm is still quite well known via word of mouth. We stopped and chatted to them for a bit and they told us they didn't end up making it to the chasm because their youngest boy started feeling ill and they decided to turn back. We wished them the best and carried on. After that the hike started feeling different. It was probably a combination of the ever-growing cliffs looming over us and the warnings creeping back into my mind, but I no longer felt welcome. Now I know it's just a feeling, but being welcome to a place is very important in Aboriginal culture, otherwise you can upset the spirits who will play tricks on you or try to hurt you. We were almost at the end of the creek bed, about 500 meters away from the chasm, when Trevor, the family friend, slipped on the rocks and twisted his back. It wasn't too bad, he could continue on, but being an older man and that far away from help, it was a bit of a worry. Trevor's injury slowed our pace a little, but we finally made it to the opening of the chasm. The opening was around 2 meters wide and exactly as the ranger described, right in the middle was a large boulder about 3 meters tall. It was much bigger than I expected and completely smooth, nothing really to grab onto. Making it even more inaccessible was the large dirty pond at the base of it. Despite the recent rain, it didn't look like fresh water. It had that dark brown color and had obviously been sitting stagnant for a while. Leaning across the pond against one side of the boulder was a decent-sized log. Someone had clearly put it there to use as a kind of ramp to help climb over. Michelle's dad was the first to try. The log looked worn and was slightly damp from yesterday's rain. He slipped slightly and almost got to the top when it cracked and he fell into the pond. The pond is full of rocks, so he got pretty badly bruised. The log crumbled down next to him. By this point I was certain we were not supposed to get into the chasm. The place basically had a do not enter sign on it. Something didn't want us there, but the adults were determined. We'd come this far. We looked all around for different options to help us in, more rocks, another log, but there was absolutely nothing. Finally Michelle's dad gave her mom a boost up onto the boulder. She's a tall lady and only just made it up. From on top of the boulder she sighed. Apparently there must have been a rock slide and the inside of the chasm had filled with rock debris, making it very difficult to get through. It was decided that even if we all managed to get over the boulder, it wasn't safe to continue on, especially with Trevor's back and Michelle's dad now bruised and soaking wet. I was slightly disappointed but also quietly relieved. The mood had completely changed. Everyone was a little sullen, and with the sun beginning to set, the gorge seemed gloomy and foreboding. Coupled with the unwelcome feeling, I think we were all ready to head back. Then, not 300 meters from the chasm, Emma suddenly tripped and sprained her ankle. I couldn't believe it. We had been warned that there had been accidents, but we didn't even get into the chasm and we had already had three ourselves. Emma is prone to the dramatics, so I thought she was hamming it up, but it turned out she was actually quite hurt and couldn't walk unsupported. The car was 3 hours away and it was getting late, so our only option was to take turns supporting her as we walked out. The walk back was grim. You know that feeling like someone is standing right behind you? It felt like that for the longest time. Michelle and I started singing to entertain ourselves, mainly Disney songs because we're dorks, and that really seemed to change the mood. It was probably just a mentality thing, but the general feel of the gorge seemed to lift a little. Maybe whatever forces were around respond well to singing? I don't know. When we got back to the cars, it was almost sunset and the wind had picked up. That was our last night at the cottage and probably also the creepiest. The wind didn't let up all night, whistling around the cottage. Trevor almost had an asthma attack. He'd left his medication at home, but luckily I had an inhaler with me. He kept thanking me the rest of the trip. A potential attack in the middle of nowhere is pretty freaking scary, I guess. The next morning we packed up. Emma's ankle was still buggered, but since we had eaten most of the food we'd brought in, we managed to create a space for her in the Land Rover so she didn't have to walk out. Michelle, her parents and I set off back through the gorge to the ranger station. After a week of hiking and exploring, we were pretty done, so everyone was fairly quiet on the walk home. Michelle and I, being younger and slightly fitter, ended up a little way ahead of her parents. We had just reached the top of a small hill at one end of the gorge when something made one of the weirdest sounds I've ever heard. Now Australian animals make weird noises. Cockatoos sound like bloody pterodactyls, but we're all outdoorsy nature people, so we know most animal noises when we hear them. The closest sound I can match it to is a camel's bellow, but with a small shriek at the end. There are feral camels in Australia, but they're mainly up north. It could have been a feral goat, but we had goats at school and it didn't sound like that. It was quite loud and echoed down the gorge, so it stopped us in our tracks. We looked around for a sign of whatever had made the noise, but we saw nothing. We ran back to Michelle's parents and they'd heard it too. They agreed it was weird and couldn't say what might have made it, but being as chilled as ever, they weren't really fussed about it. It was so odd, just one single cry like someone yelling and stay out before slamming the door on you. That was an amazing trip. I learnt and experienced so much. But the biggest thing I took away from it was to always respect Indigenous culture. I'm not at all religious and only vaguely spiritual, but I completely believe that the Aboriginals are connected to the land on a level we will never understand. They know things, and if they say not to go somewhere, it's in your best interest to listen. I'm currently a ranger, and before this, I had another job at a different park that I will probably never step foot in again after what I experienced there last year. For the record, it's very busy during the day, I got a lot of visitors and did a lot of walkthroughs and tours. My favorite part about the job was that everybody left at night. I would have the park all to myself as I was the only one working that shift. I love nature, and I'm happiest when I'm outside, so this was the perfect job for me. One day, an older lady came in and asked for a tour. She was by far the nicest person I'd met, and she seemed to enjoy my company for some reason. She stalled the tour as much as she could, calling me a child the entire time when saying something or making a statement or asking a question that seemed sweet to me. She was just so sincere, and to share my same passion was wonderful. She later told me that she realized we pretty much felt the same way about nature and even had a very similar connection. I felt something warm about this lady that I could not really describe, but I didn't mind spending the entire day showing her around. As it got darker, she began to get sad, and I asked her about it. She told me that she was sad about her time with me passing, and I told her she could come here anytime if she wanted to talk. She thanked me and said that she hoped she would have a chance to come again. In her voice and eyes, I saw that somehow she believed she would never see me again after that night. It was overall sad, and I wondered if she had a disease or something and was dying, but I thought it rude to ask, so I didn't. She said she wanted to show me something and took me to the last part of the park, where there was this beautiful fountain. She told me how the fountain was made of marble and it was probably the most beautiful fountain that would ever be built because it was built by her grandfather, whom she loved very much. When she was a little girl, she would often come to the edge and look at the water, imagining what her life would end up like, but she never hoped it would turn out like it did. She was very calm and seemed like she was at peace with everything around her and inside of her. I couldn't believe somebody could be that peaceful. Although I told her I would be happy if she came around here more often, the sadness in her eyes remained. She took my face in her hands and told me she was proud of me, that it turned out just the way she could have hoped. That kind of confused me, but I didn't want to ask. She said it was time to say goodbye. I went behind the fountain to follow her to see where she was going, but nobody was there. Now, I was weirded out because I didn't know where this old lady had disappeared to. I asked the guy at the reception if an older lady with her description had left, and he said no older women had come in today at all. The whole thing was extremely weird, but I ignored it and went on with my day. Now, fast forward 2 months later, I was looking through my mom's photo album, and I saw a picture of the old lady. I was shocked and asked my mother who that was. What she told me made me question my reality and my memory to this day. She said that she was my great-grandmother. I still believe that something unexplainable happened to me. The next day, I quit my job. If I ever saw that fountain again, I would ask about it, and I'm too afraid to find out if what that woman told me is true. It was 2009-ish. I was living on the road for 2 years, hitchhiking and riding trains. I was a dumb 18 to 19 year old. I had been all over the country, West Coast multiple times, Southwest, and decided to see the East Coast. Went to Florida and went to a small festival there. It's called a rainbow gathering. They're kind of like big meetups of traveler kids, old hippies, tramps, those kinds of people. They're always in state parks or national parks. Rangers will patrol it and police sometimes show up, but for some reason it's allowed. Not sure how, but these have been going on since the 70s, I think. Some people who show up are hardcore train hopper gutter punk types, and some are super chill Christians who will wash your feet. It's a very unusual festival. There are smaller regional gatherings and a big national gathering where thousands of people show up. Kind of the poor man's Burning Man. Huge fire pits get dug out, elaborate latrines, hundreds of drum circles, free food is constantly made from kitchens which are just camps devoted to making food for all us bums. Well, I met some friends at a smaller regional one in Florida and we parted ways never thinking I was going to see them again. One was named Anna and we sort of hit it off. I hitchhiked north all the way to upstate New York when I caught wind of the national gathering, which was going to be in Pennsylvania. I figured I might as well go. I got to this gathering early, in the Allegheny National Park, and helped set up, trying to meet people, kind of looking for my group, not sure where I was going to be camping. One day I ran into Anna, who I had met in Florida. Me and her had some spiritual conversations in Florida, talking about fairies and UFOs. She had some unusual stuff happen to her when she was a kid. So she and her buddy had just gotten to PA, and we decided the three of us were going to team up. We noticed a ton of people showing up to this thing. It was getting really crowded, so we decided to move camp to a more remote area. We chose a spot off of the main trail, which goes from the parking lot to the gathering. It's a couple miles long, and there's a lot of foot traffic going up and down, people going in and out of the festival, but we had some space. This happened around dusk. Me and Anna were sitting by our little twig fire, stone cold sober. Alcohol isn't really allowed at a gathering. It does still get in, but there's a camp at the parking lot called A Camp where all the drinkers stay. There's of course other drugs at these festivals, but me and Anna and her friend just weren't into the whole drum circle scene. We had just gotten done having a deep talk about spirituality when we started to feel hungry and stood up to start heading down to the main circle, which is where everyone can get one big meal a day. We're standing up when Anna says, "Hey, do you hear that?" And I said no, and just kept putting out the fire with my foot, and she was like, "No, hey, shh, listen." So I stopped and I could hear the sound of someone walking through the forest. The thing that was weird about it was that it was coming from a direction where there was no festival. So the festival was down below us about a half mile if we were looking down the trail, and this sound was coming from our left where it's just hundreds of miles of Pennsylvania woods. The parking lot is way up the trail a few miles behind us. It was odd because it sounded like a person speed walking towards us. I didn't think deer because they wouldn't be coming up to a fire pit. I genuinely thought it was just some lost hippie. As this sound was getting closer, there were some people walking down the trail and some walking up the trail. There's a weird custom called Nick at Night. If you yell Nick at Night, a dude with a tin can full of tobacco will come find you and roll you a cigarette. There's about 10 of them walking around, and their sole job is to maintain everyone's nicotine habit. They get a ton of donations from A Camp. So anyways, these two groups run into a Nick at Night kid and now are all standing together on the main trail talking about 10 meters below us, oblivious to us. So while that's happening to our right and below us, this sound of someone walking from our left has gotten so close that we should be seeing who or what it was, and there just wasn't anything there. I was frozen, kind of stuck in a state of confusion, and I think Anna was too. No fear, just why aren't we seeing it? We could visibly see leaves and dirt being kicked up, like there was an invisible person power walking by. Whatever it was, it went right up to that group of people on the main trail and didn't stop, but it slowed down like it was checking them out. They were totally oblivious to this. They were all smoking, talking and laughing. It kind of did a turn as it went up to them and then suddenly did a straight line towards me and Anna. Anna had a keychain with a million things on it, and she was frantically looking for this mini flashlight she had on it. It was dusk, so not bright out, but still light enough we could see the footfalls and debris being kicked up. My mind was thinking there's a squirrel or a field mouse hopping on the forest floor or something. The forest floor was covered in dead leaves, but these steps were quick, as if this was a child or a small person walking fast. It's hard to explain with writing. This thing came right up to us. I'm standing to the right of our smoldering fire and Anna to the left. I could hear her just struggling with this keychain. It came right up to me, probably 5 or 6 feet away. There was nothing there. It did the same thing with the group. It slowed its pace like it was checking us out, like a slow trot. As it went by, Anna said hey and shone the light where it was, nothing to see, and whatever this thing was took off up the hill. Just absolutely took off. It was so fast. The footfalls became like a machine gun. If I had wanted to run after it, I couldn't have. A second later, me and Anna took off running the opposite direction, past that group, and just kept going till we were at the bottom. Funny thing happened. There's people at these gatherings who spend the whole month naked. They'll roll around in mud and just look like mud people for the whole festival. One of these people we had seen around was this 7-foot giant of a man, probably 400 pounds, naked, covered in mud and leaves. Me and Anna are in full flight mode, and at this point it's dark, and we run right into this guy. Scared us so bad, Anna screamed and we all started laughing, and that sort of canceled out the panic. We went to go find our other friend, and it was weird because Anna was very scared. She kept saying it was because of her, like she had a weird fairy, alien situation happened to her as a kid with her mom, and she felt like whatever this was because of her. I don't know, but she did not want to talk about it after, and I could never get her to elaborate. Me and this other friend, we were all about it. We went back up there. Anna said she wasn't going and wanted us to pack up the tent, and we sort of hung out, tried to look for tracks with our lights, listened, nothing happened. I've gone from thinking it was an alien, like a gray, to a ghost. Or maybe a fairy or a gnome. One person said it could have been a Pukwudgie. These are like Native American gnome things that are tricksters and can turn invisible. They are supposed to be in that area. So I don't know. I'm a patrol officer in North Central New Mexico. My partner and I park our patrol vehicles at the bottom of a long dirt road that leads to an abandoned school. We only do this on the night shift when it starts to get slow around 1 a.m. It's a relatively safe place for us to catch up on paperwork. We have had several odd experiences there, from strange lights that maneuver quickly in the woods, to possible UFO sightings. We even found a body down there years ago that still has not been identified. But that's not even the most terrifying. This was in October of 2020 at around 2 a.m. It was a dead night, and crime was low that time of year, partly because of C-19 and partly because it was cold. We had parked our vehicles side by side, facing opposite directions so that the driver's side windows lined up. This is common in our line of work. My partner gets dispatched to a noise complaint and leaves. I use this time to step out and relieve my bladder. As I'm standing outside, I hear a whistle in the woods across the abandoned school grounds. These woods are roughly 100 yards from where I am parked. The whistle was a tune like it came from a human mouth, and it was oddly loud. We do have a homeless problem in my town, but not in the area I patrol. I assume a homeless person who must have wandered their way to the south side of the town. I get back in my car and roll my window up, anxiously awaiting my partner's return. My partner returns after about 20 minutes. I tell him the story and we move on to other topics. I'm a believer in the paranormal, but he is a skeptic. Within about 30 minutes, he decides that he needs to relieve himself. So he steps out and walks to the rear of his patrol car. He's back there for roughly 5 seconds, and boom, we hear it again. A loud whistle to the tune of a slow song. The whistle lasts for maybe 10 seconds. He walks back to my window and his face is a pale milky white. So, as cops do, we decided to investigate. We grab our flashlights and start walking slowly through the field. That grass is up to our waist. We get to about halfway in the field when we hear it again, but this time it sounds like it's coming from our right side, where the school is. As we are standing there with our flashlights shining on the school, we begin to see the grass start to move. There is no wind, and the grass is not moving around us. It looks like something is crawling in the field. The grass is moving slowly, in a straight path towards us. We begin walking towards the movement. At this point, we both have our hands on our firearms. The air is eerily still, and you could see our breath from the cold. I can tell that my partner is uneasy. We are walking very slowly and quietly. As we get about 20 feet away from the moving grass, it stops. Then we hear the whistle coming from exactly where our flashlights are shining on the now still grass. We are frozen in fear. We are too scared to speak to each other. It feels like minutes pass, but was probably only a few seconds. I go to take a step forward and all of a sudden the grass starts to move again. This time away from us towards the wood line. Only this time it's fast. Too fast for us to run after. So we just stand and watch. We watch as the moving grass reaches the woods. We both have our flashlights focused on it. And again, the whistle. Coming from the woods where the grass just stopped moving. Only this time, the whistle is quiet. This is the part that shocks us. We are now shining our flashlights into the woods, There are several large trees in our view. This thing stands up. It looked like a child, but not. It's hard to explain, but it was humanoid in form and it had illuminated blue eyes.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Despite our flashlights shining directly onto the figure, it seemed clouded in darkness. Before we could even call out, it stepped behind a tree and was gone. We gathered up the courage to go after it. As we get to the tree, there is nothing. No footprints, no leaves crunching like you would expect to hear in autumn. It was like it vanished into nothing. We spent the next hour checking reports for missing children in the area, and we could find nothing. The creepiest part is that it must have been running on all fours when it was in the grass. We have a children's psychiatric hospital in the town, but they had no reports of escapees. To this day we cannot explain it. And to this day we continue to park there. 3 years have passed and we never had another experience like that. But my partner is now a believer. And everyone in the department thinks we are crazy. I decided that I would share some of my grandfather's stories he told me about his time working as a forester in Michigan's Manistee National Forest. He never got a chance to write any of his experiences down, so I thought I might post them here. For some background, my grandpa started working in the Manistee area in 1949, when he was 28 years old. Before then he had been drifting around the region, doing odd jobs in logging until he was hired by the Forest Service in the northwest part of Michigan's Lower Peninsula. The work, as I understand, was slow and most days he and his crew were sent to different parts of the forest to address various tree and land concerns. Grandpa was always an avid outdoorsman, and he enjoyed hunting and fishing just about as much as anyone in the region. Sadly, he died in December of 1998, when I was still rather young, but I remember whenever we went to visit him and Grandma, he would sit my brother and me down and tell us about his days in the Forest Service. Working outside every day allowed him to witness all sorts of wildlife, like black bears, whitetail, foxes, and even bobcats back in those days. He often relived his encounters with bears while he was deep in the forest, telling us that those moments were some of the most memorable of his life, being up close to such beautiful and powerful animals. Usually, his tales were exciting, and the enthusiasm with which he told them inspired us to go out to the backyard and look for animals in between the pines. Although there wasn't much wildlife around Grandma and Grandpa's property, they still always kept a close eye on us and never let us wander too far from the house. Finally, a few years before his death, Grandpa deemed my brother and me old enough to be told why. I was about 9, and my brother was about 11 when Grandpa first opened up about the strangest things that had ever happened to him. All our childhoods we had heard him go on and on about the peace that the wilderness brought him, or used to bring him, But this time his tone was completely different. I don't remember all the details, but I asked my brother to help piece together Grandpa's story, and my dad as well. He too had heard of the experiences in question, multiple times. It was the mid-50s, he never gave the exact year, and October had rolled in behind cool autumn breezes and the sound of Canada geese flying southward. The first of his strange stories had occurred at night, as he was driving home from a local bar where he and his crew had spent the last few hours after work. It was a windy night, and the pines on either side of the road were blowing ferociously. No moon or stars could be seen through thick cloud cover, so the only illumination of the road ahead came from Grandpa's headlights. By his reckoning, he must have been going close to 50 miles per hour at the very moment when something huge leapt across the road not 20 feet ahead of him. His headlights had shown the animal's silhouette. It was dog-shaped, but massive, almost stretching all the way across the road. It only made one bound to get from one side to the other, and its size alone was enough to unnerve Grandpa. At the time, he had assumed that the animal was just a very large wolf, except timber wolves hadn't been spotted in that region for decades. He considered it a bizarre encounter, but nothing came of it that night and he was able to return home without anything else strange happening to him. The second of his stories admittedly frightened me enough to avoid going outside at night for years. Even now I'm wary of noises in the dark because of the obvious fear in Grandpa's voice when he told us of his second experience. Some details here were provided by my dad. It occurred in the same month as his first encounter, a few weeks later, on a night that was pretty cold for the season. It may have hit 40 degrees, but it was a calm night with little wind. Grandpa's house at the time was really small, and it stood in a lot with about six other similarly sized and built edifices. None of his neighbors tended to stay up very late, so it surprised him to be awakened by loud noises at about 1 in the morning. They sounded like scratching on sheet metal, with occasional thumps and bumps like an animal was trying to get in. Grandpa apparently got up, fetched a flashlight, put on his boots, and went out into the front room, the walls of which consisted of mosquito screens stretched between wooden framework. Once in the front room, Grandpa could hear the sounds more clearly, and they were coming from the nearest of his neighbor's homes maybe 50 yards to his right. It was incredibly dark out there, with no streetlights to illuminate. The neighbor's house had a porch light on, but Grandpa couldn't make out what was creating the racket through the screen, so he slowly opened the front door and looked out. He described to us in great detail the animals that he saw there, and he always said he would remember them exactly as they were, for fear brands memories the strongest. Three massive dogs covered in long black hair were up against his neighbor's house, scratching at the siding and making visible claw marks with every swipe. Each beast stood about 7 feet tall, with their front legs stretching for another 2 or 3 feet and easily reaching the roofing and the gutter of the house. Their scratching, however, did not make it seem like they were trying to get into the house, as Grandpa explained. He thought that they were doing that to get whoever was inside out. The next part was actually the hardest to get out of Grandpa. It was strange that he was so eager to tell us everything thus far, despite how he felt about the subject. But he was rather hesitant as I remember to divulge the last horrifying details of his encounter. He claims that the animals then noticed that he had emerged from his own house, just across the lawn, for each one turned to look straight at him, just 50 yards away. They had pointed ears like a wolf's, and huge bodies that rivaled large black bears in size. They also supported themselves not with four legs, like any other native mammal, but instead, they stood on two legs each, towering 7 feet above the ground. The sounds that they proceeded to make, Grandpa had said, would haunt his dreams for the rest of his life. It was a shame that he could neither produce recordings nor accurately mimic the UN wolf-like screams the animals made, for that detail always fascinated me the most about his story. They didn't sound like foxes, coyotes, or bobcats. Instead, they forced half-scream, half howls out of their jaws that Grandpa was sure held the teeth of a carnivore. Grandpa never told us exactly what happened next. I guess we assumed that he ran inside, locked the doors, and didn't look outside until morning. He would tell us that four of his neighbors, including the elderly couple that lived in the nearest house, didn't stick around very long. He did say that he tried to talk to them about what had happened that night, but they remained evasive and never gave him any straight answers. That turned out to be somewhat ironic because Grandpa himself kept tight-lipped about many of the details of his stories. He would say that he heard those exact screams on two other occasions, both times while he was in the Manistee Forest, and he showed us an old Forest Service report detailing a possible timber wolf sighting in the area, complete with photographs of huge padded paw prints in mud. The thing is, Grandpa never told anyone his stories but his most trusted family, which is unique among Michigan dogman witnesses. After the craze that Steve Cook's legend song stirred in the 80s, it's no wonder that so many stories from the region surfaced. I had heard a few bits and pieces about the so-called monster before Grandpa told his tale, but it wasn't until later in life that I realized his encounters had to have been with the same creature. Whether I believe him that massive wolves walk upright through Michigan forests, well, I'm still not so sure. But as a modern zoological curiosity, the stories of strange beasts from a passionate woodsman who knew his wildlife certainly remain among the most remarkable I've heard, simply because of the genuine emotion with which he related his tales. Legends like these might just be figments of our collective imagination, so all I can do is present what I've heard and let others judge for themselves what is real and what is pure fiction. Anyway, as the song goes, don't go out at night. I'm a Silicon Valley, San Jose, California, native and have frequented the adjacent Santa Cruz Mountains all my life. This incident happened on the Loma Prieta Grade Trail in the forest of Nisene Mark State Park in the late summer of 2019. My girlfriend at the time and I were hiking on a Wednesday morning. There were already people around. This is a popular trail as it's a really beautiful locale. That said, there were also stretches when it was just the two of us. I think it's a 5-mile hike total and we were about an hour in when my girlfriend had to relieve herself. There were thick trees on both sides, so we looked for a clearing on our right side. We saw not really a path, but an opening, and walked past the tree line, maybe 20 to 30 feet in. She wanted to be out of sight of anyone who passed by. I tossed her my backpack which had toilet paper and she ducked behind a tree. I walked back down the clearing about halfway, but I could still see her. She's squatting and I'm just waiting. Like I said, I could see her the whole time. It was darker inside the trees obviously, but I could still see just fine. So I'm standing there with nothing to do but look around me. That's when I caught the movement of something on my left. There was a medium-sized tree with a very distinct, very dark, hand on it. It was about 10 or so feet away. At first, I thought it was someone wearing black gloves. I don't know why, but I immediately thought it was some biker pervert looking in on my girlfriend. That's when I saw the face peek out and everything turned upside down. I can't say with full certainty, but I'd say it was 7 to 8 feet tall, easy. I'm 6 foot 2. I only saw a half of it, but it was everything you would expect from a classic description of Bigfoot: big black eyes, large flat nose, dark skinned with blackish grayish hair. I could see only a hint of a conical skull. Really, based on nothing in particular, I feel like I saw a female. Not sure why, I just do. Anyway, it peeked back and forth twice. The eyes were mesmerizing, that's the best way to describe it. They felt like they were looking right through my soul. I wasn't scared really, but I was definitely in shock, like the way seeing a car accident feels like everything is in slow motion. And let me confirm what others say, there was no way I had the wherewithal to pull out my phone and take a picture. No way. I was totally engrossed in the moment. This was all in the space of maybe 20 to 30 seconds. The second time it peeked out, it looked at me for a few seconds then ducked back behind the tree but also sank like it was going onto the ground. That was the last I saw of it. My girlfriend finally finished and when she came back toward me, that was when the fear hit me. Not like I was in danger right at that moment, but more like the reality of what I saw finally hit me. I quickly took her hand and pulled her back onto the trail. I didn't say what I saw, but I said we had to go back ASAP. She was confused, but I explained to her what I saw as we walked back, at a much brisker pace than when we came up. She believed me. She's Canadian and has an uncle and cousin who claimed to see one when she was growing up, so that was good. She actually wanted to turn around and see if we could find it, but I wasn't quite in that space just after it happened. I'd say I was generally a Bigfoot believer before this, but not anywhere near a fanatic or anything, and it's not like I set out looking for anything. I know people argue that if you have Bigfoot on the brain, you're more likely to jump to that conclusion in certain situations. I did not. In fact, the whole hike I was complaining to my girlfriend about my manager at work. Bigfoot was the last thing on my mind. I'm okay with what happened, but I had strange dreams for weeks after. My girlfriend thought it was a great story and she'd tell our friends over beers and stuff, but I'm not entirely comfortable with people knowing. But like I said, I'm far away from it now to at least share it here. Yeah, it's possible a huge guy in a suit was out there at that exact time and in that exact spot, but I don't think so. I'm 99% sure I saw a Sasquatch. I have heard of and seen reptoid beings in the area 5 miles east of Phoenix, Arizona. The Superstition Mountain has been an area of encounters and is said to have both an alien base and laboratories under it. The military also has an underground base there and interacts in experiments with the aliens. About 20 years ago, I encountered an individual that spent time exploring some of the old mines in the area. He had vanished for months before I ran into him again. I asked him where he had been all this time. Here is his story. He spotted a mine entrance on the west side of the main mount side. He said that the mine looked to be in good shape, so he started walking in the shaft. He had gone about a half mile in when he saw a sign that said no entrance beyond this point. The mine shaft was still in good shape, so he went in 100 yards. He told me that people seemed to come out of the walls of the shaft. Men in black uniforms questioned him and then took him to a holding area in Mesa, Arizona for 72 hours. They questioned him again and found out that his home was in Colorado. They gave him a plane ticket to Denver, Colorado, and told him never to come back to the Phoenix area. He asked me not to tell anyone that I had seen him. He wanted to pick up personal items that got left behind. I have never seen him after that. There are other stories of treasure hunters going into old mine shafts and finding holographic walls in the shaft. They did not try to enter the area behind the wall as they feared that they might not be able to get back out. They told me that they took a round rock and rolled it through the screen and heard it roll for some distance. One of them reached through the screen with a flashlight in his hand. He turned the flashlight back toward the screen, but could not see any light. He said that he withdrew his arm as he had the feeling that something was back there and he didn't want it to grab his arm and drag him in. I asked the men to take me up there and show me the mine. They all said no way they were going back in there. We got a topo map out and they showed me the area where they had encountered the wall. I did go into the area to search but was never able to find the mine. This is not strange as other people have found an opening and marked the entrance with a pyramid of large rocks and left to get lights and more people and equipment. When they got back, the rocks were still there as they had stacked them, but the entrance is gone. There have been sightings of reptoids about 9 feet tall in that area. As soon as they sense that they are being watched, they vanish. People have also seen lizard beings about the size of a man with bat-like wings and a tail. They fly out to the opening in the cliffs at twilight and also vanish since they are being watched. The Native Americans have seen these things for hundreds of years and have legends about them. They say that they are shapeshifters and can make you see them in any form they want. I found this out on a personal encounter with a reptoid I encountered on a trail. As I was walking up an inner trail in the mounts, I looked up and saw a man coming towards me on the trail. He had appeared out of thin air. As I walked toward him, I noticed his eyes. They were reptoid, vertical slits. When he sensed that I knew what he was, he hit me with a psychic blow that I can only describe as being hit in the head with a sledgehammer. It stunned me and almost drove me to my knees. As I shook this off, I looked up and he was gone. I had a headache for 2 days after that and think that he could have killed me if he wanted to. This is just some of the strange things that have been seen up there. We have seen different types of alien craft that appear to enter the main mount, ghost orbs and UFO orbs that have been seen in different areas for hundreds of years that disappear at different old mines and wells, and some just enter the face of the mounts. I would love to get in touch with a well-equipped investigative group and have them check out some of the strong magnetic fields that may act as dimensional portholes where some of these creatures come and go. The fact that the encounter in Missouri was in a Navy storage area is no surprise. They have been given reign over housing UFOs and aliens since the formation of MJ-12 after the Roswell crash. One day our government may tell us the truth on their involvement with alien encounters and tech that has been traded for their abduction of us. First off, I would like to say I am not sure what these things are. All of this is 100% true. My dad and brother have lake houses right next to each other in upstate New York on Lake Ontario. They are in a very secluded area on a peninsula. You can only get there by boat or by walking down a mile-long path deep through a forest. One winter morning, we were all getting ready to go out and play after a night of heavy snowfall. My uncle looked out the window toward the path we used to get back and forth from the parking lot to our houses. As he looked out, he saw a pair of the eeriest, strangest-looking deer he or I had ever seen. They had all gray fur, long dark almond-shaped eyes that stared intently, and their antlers were two long jagged horns protruding straight out from their skull. These deer were like none either of us had seen. My grandmother walked outside to take pictures of them. After she snapped a few pictures, they seemed to just walk away. The two deer silently strolled into the woods, not making a single sound. They did not even have to hop the slightest bit through the foot of snow on the ground. What makes this even weirder and actually startling has to do with the pictures. After looking back, neither of the deer showed up in any of the pictures taken. The camera was fine, as everything but where the deer were standing was clearly photographed. Even what was behind the deer showed up in the photos. When we walked over to where they had been walking, no more snow had fallen. This was a minute or two after they walked away. No tracks were found. The snow appeared untouched. I know this story isn't exactly scary, but it is intriguing and a strange mystery. A few years later, my cousins and I were walking down the path. We all have a strange feeling I can only describe as dread. It was like the feeling you get when you are sitting outside the principal's office waiting to be called in. We looked over and saw two deer just like the ones before. The forest floor around the path was covered in leaves and dry brush, but we did not hear them walking around. The two deer were pacing, watching us. At least that's how I felt at the time and still feel to this day. The deer turned their heads simultaneously the second we looked at them. We exchanged excruciating eye contact for around 10 seconds or so. It could have been longer for all I know. It just felt so odd. Then they proceeded to walk over a hill out of sight. We did not hear them walk away. It's like they float above the ground. This was in the early 2000s and they have not been seen since. This is still a topic of conversation for our family to this day. Also, there are many other creepier things that I have seen up at our lake house if anyone is interested. We still talk about it. I've been reading about the Glimmer Man phenomenon and its similarity to the cloaked alien in the Predator film series. I saw something very similar a few years ago. It was probably about 4 years ago. I lived in the very northern part of Frederick County, Maryland, near Thurmont, not too far south of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Behind my house was a few acres of woods with a small creek right past the tree line. We had about 2 acres of lawn before the woods started. This area of Frederick County is very rural, with lots of forests and farms, very near Cunningham Falls State Park, a huge wooded area with lakes and the tallest waterfall in the state. In fact, Camp David is located in the area. Anyway, I was sitting on my second story back deck and noticed movement in the tree line. It was a nice day, I think early fall. It was not a hot day and not raining. I saw the outline of something big moving perpendicular away from me in the woods. It was a shimmer, like heat waves, completely invisible except you can see the air being displaced, and made me think of the Predator right away because it was just like heat waves rising from a hot surface. It seemed to be a humanoid shape in that it was taller than wide, like a tall, fit, bipedal outline. It was hard to judge the height from my perspective in the distance, but it was taller than the average man, probably about 10 feet tall at least. I never heard of someone else seeing something similar before. I only saw it once, and that was enough for me. In 1987, I experienced an event which I later recalled while under hypnosis. After the regression session, I was able to remember some other details, including that I had missed about 3 hours during the incident. I was living in Arizona near the Santa Catalina Mountains. One afternoon, as I was sitting in a lounge chair on our back porch, I suddenly realized that I was being dragged into a craft by two small aliens. The next thing I remembered was waking up on a table inside the small craft. A guide greeted me and gave me something to drink. I believe that it was a stimulant of some kind because I was not sleepy after I drank the substance. In fact, the taste was quite pleasing. I was then taken out of the craft, looked around, noticed I was standing on top of a hill. It was dark, but I noticed a light near a cavern. I walked up to this area, and it was then that I saw a man, dressed in a red military-type jumpsuit. My guide seemed to know this man as he greeted him. I also noticed that he wore some type of patch and was carrying an automatic weapon. When we walked into the tunnel, I realized they were going right into the side of a large hill or mountain. There we met with another guard in red, and I saw a computerized checkpoint with two cameras on each side. To my left was a large groove where a small transit vehicle carried people further inside. To my right, I saw a long hallway where there were many offices. We took the transit car and went for what seemed to be a very long time to another secure area. I was then told to step onto some type of device that looked like a scale and face the computer screen. I saw lights flashing and numbers computing, and then a card was issued with holes punched into it. It appeared to be an ID card. My guide did not speak much but did tell me that we had just entered level 1 of the facility. I was eventually transported to a lower level where I witnessed additional armed guards. I was then taken down another hall, and there I noticed a horrible putrid smell. I then saw huge tanks with computerized gauges hooked to them and a huge arm-like device that extended from the top of some tubing down into the tanks. In a large laboratory-like room, I noticed a small gray being with his back turned to me working on something at a computer. I was then told to sit at a table in the middle of the room. About this time, a man, human, dressed like a doctor entered the room. He wore a white lab coat with a badge. The temperature in the room seemed awfully cold. By this time I was frustrated and began to cry and to tremble. Then suddenly I felt a stabbing pain. Screamed, and the human doctor stood next to me and rubbed something over my stomach. The pain immediately subsided. Soon I became drowsy and was returned to the porch. When I awoke, I was laying on the porch floor by the door. For several months after that day, I knew something had happened, but I was unable to comprehend what it was. That is why I sought medical help. I have not had any other encounters, but believe that I will in the future, though I was never told this. One day in autumn 2015, I came home from school early as I skipped the last three classes. I lived in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It was around 12 noon. All the lights in my house were off, and I was wearing earphones. I went from my kitchen to the living room, and as I looked at the small couch we have in my parents' house, I saw a thing staring back at me. It wasn't for a split second, it was staring at me for like 3 to 5 seconds, front facing me, so I know it wasn't just my brain, eyes mistaking a random object for a human-sized being. It wasn't very tall, about 5 feet would be the tallest it could have been. It had a human-like body shape. Its skin looked like candle wax, and it was very wrinkly. Kind of reminded me of E.T., but it looked way more old and pretty much dead. Its hands weren't human-like and had long dark nails. Its eyes were all black and they looked hollow. It had brownish hair on its head, legs, and arms. It didn't do anything, just stared at me for some seconds. I looked away or blinked, I don't remember which one, and it left or just vanished. When it looked at me, I felt both terrified and in awe. But it looked familiar, even if I haven't seen it before, or since. I felt like its intentions weren't necessarily bad. I don't think it was a hallucination, because there is no history of schizophrenia or anything similar in the family. There is no history of any mental illness on both sides. I would like to know if anyone knows anything about this creature or if anyone has a similar experience. I don't think it had ears. As for a nose, I don't remember clearly. If it did have a nose, it was just a small black opening on its face, where a human's nose would normally be. Its face was a mixture of demonic and alien features, only the body was humanoid. Its eyes didn't indicate aggressive behavior exactly. It was more that it was staring at me out of curiosity, but it looked pretty alert and ready to fight back. Its face was wax-like and wrinkly like the rest of its body. A weird kind of oval shape if I recall correctly. So I'm 45 now. I was thinking about this randomly and was bored, so I decided to ask if anyone had an experience with the board. A real experience. I'm actually afraid to talk about it. I was 12 when I first started using one by myself. It started moving just fine. I became obsessed with it and used it regularly for about a year and a half. There was a name. When I asked who I was talking to, it spelled out Bobby Mihalovich. I'm not sure of the spelling of his last name, so I don't know. All I know is I'm afraid to talk about it because I did it by myself for a few years, and I can still remember that it was moving on its own. I would even try to trick it sometimes by lifting my fingers off the planchette, and it would continue to move for about an inch before stopping. One time it even levitated while I was using it with my brother and friend. You could feel the pressure of the plastic pushing on our fingers upward, and we pulled away when it got to be a few inches in the air. But I'm mostly concerned with my own experiences and using it by myself. I mean, I used to come home from school and just hop on the board like no big deal. No one told me it was fake or demonic. I just thought it worked. It felt creepy but natural at the same time. What I'm telling you is the truth. I saw, felt it move. I talked to this thing for hours. I was old enough to know if it was fake or bogus. I see a lot of people telling stories about the board, but I don't believe them because if you really had used one the way I did, you wouldn't want to talk about it. Until now, anyway. Is there anyone else out there who has experienced this? Bobby Mihalovich? I've been wanting to speak about this for a while. This happened around April 2018 while I was staying at my aunt's apartment in Aurora, Colorado. Her apartment was located on the second top floor behind a high school field. It was around 2 to 3 in the morning, and I got up to use the restroom when I decided to stop by the kitchen and look out the window. To my surprise, I came across what I can only imagine as a skinwalker. It was pale and had glowing eyes along with spider-like limbs. It was digging into the ground, and I was too shocked in the moment to think about recording. It's been 5 years since then, and I can't stop thinking about it. Has anybody ever come across this, or does anybody have any additional information about this? I'd love to know, please.